Hello and welcome to the Great American Novel Podcast. I'm Scott Yarbrough.
And I'm Kirk Kernut.
And Kirk, today we have a very different episode for those people who've been with us through our first dozen or so episodes. We're moving a little bit different direction now. Not permanently, but just a special episode reflecting the kind of crazy busy time we had at the end of summer and the opening of fall semester. So why don't you tell our listeners what we're doing this episode.
We thought we'd take a little break from the great American novel in the canon, so to speak, and take a step back and delve into a genre that Scott and I are both huge fans of and that really has in the past 40 years or so kind of blurred the line between what is popular fiction and what is literary fiction, and that is noir fiction. Now that's a term we need to define. So we're basically talking hard-boiled fiction, sometimes with a detective, sometimes with a criminal. But I would say overall, Scott, you and I are huge fans and big consumers. And for a time in my life, I even fancied myself very briefly attempted to write crime novels. But we love this genre. So why do we love it?
We love it because on the one hand, it does what all the best fiction does, which is it challenges us to get out of our own tracks a little bit and look at things as they really are. It also gives us a plot to hang things on. And when it comes to the hard-boiled stuff, not only are we talking, of course, all the problems we might typically have with violence and darkness and kind of pessimistic, cynical outlooks, but also often terse, tough, well-crafted writing. And I think maybe that's where we come from. And that shows the evolution of where this comes in the whole tradition of crime writing and detective writing. So the term noir, Kirk, starts as a film studies term in the 40s by a guy named Nino Frank. And he's talking about all those great films come out in the late 30s, early 40s, mostly from Warner Brothers Pictures, but a few other studios, United States, that are real dark, and they use that chiaroscuro black and white. And although you have color films starting to arrive by the late 30s, famously, everyone remembers that moment in The Wizard of Oz, we still mostly see all these in black and white. And so then the term roman noir, which just means literary noir. But of course, the literary noir predates these films, which are based on all these great novels. Now, the earliest detective and crime novels, of course, are what we call an English tradition, although ironically, it's created by an American, Edgar Allan Poe, who has a few stories, Murders in Rue Morgue and A Purloined Letter, that are about a detective who likes to stay home and wear his sunglasses, smoke his pipe, and play his violin while he talks to his buddy, who's less intelligent, who tells a story and goes out to figure out what the cops are doing. And the police inspectors are always a few steps behind. He comes back and tells his friend Auguste Dupin what is going on, who then, you know, through ratiocination, which you and I might call deductive reasoning, solves a crime sitting there at home, usually.
And I think we're well aware that Auguste Dupin is a French term that translates into Sherlock Holmes.
That's exactly right. And we have a kind of one little step between Sherlock Holmes and Poe. And to give Arthur Conan Doyle credit, he always said, when they said, where'd you get the idea? He goes, well, those Poe stories. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he ever denied it or tried to. It's not like the guys who did the television show Deadwood, who pretended they'd never read the book by Pete Dexter titled Deadwood.
Right.
We have Wilkie Collins in the middle, 1850s, 1860s, and a couple of Charles Dickens characters, like in Bleak House, who are detective type characters. And so that sets up the English style. So, Kirk, in just like a few lines, how would you describe the English style detective story?
Well, the English style is, you mentioned the term ratiocination, and that's really what it is. It's a mind game. It's a puzzle. It is a bringing together of clues in order to find a rational explanation for this mystery. And I think that's really kind of the main point of these types of detective stories. You know, Miss Marple, Agatha Christie is another example of this. In all of these cases, what the ratiocination is doing is proving that there is a logical or rational form to the world and that we can deduce it if we just put our mind to it enough. I think one of the downsides, I appreciate those Poe stories. And in fact, I would encourage readers that are into true crime to look into some of the background of the Dupin stories. I'm particularly fascinated by the the murder of Marie Roget,
right,
which is kind of the one, the middle one that nobody really talks about, because I think dramatically it's just not that interesting. But Poe did some really interesting research and transposed a contemporary murder over across the Atlantic to France. Right. And it was kind of a fun mystery game for folks at that time. So it's an example of how true crime gets translated into literature pretty well.
Right.
The downside of it, and I think maybe the most popular one of these types of detectives in the 1920s, S.S. Van Dyne.
The Philo Vance novels.
Philo Vance, exactly. That kind of exemplifies maybe why hard-boiled fiction came about in the began in the 1920s, largely in response to the popularity of characters like Philo Vance.
Right.
S.S. Van Dyne, interestingly enough, published by Scribner's, which was, Max Perkins was his, essentially discovered him and promoted all
those Fitzgerald and Hemingway's publisher and
exactly.
So many other, Thomas Wolfe's, all these other
exactly.
writers.
Exactly. But Philo Vance is an insufferably pompous detective.
Yes.
And there's a sense with these kind of eccentric Sherlock Holmes types that they're never going to be wrong. They know it all. And they kind of just become, I think, by the end of the 20s, dramatically uninteresting.
Right. And the other thing, of course, is we're always dealing with the upper classes in some isolated
right.
area. It's never to a drug deal gone bad,
right.
which results in a shooting. It's never a drunken husband attacks his wife and then goes on the run. You know, the kind of things we know about happen in real life almost never appear. And so Raymond Chandler, who writes an essay about this called The Simple Art of Murder, famously says Dashiell Hammett took murder out of the Venetian vase and put it back in the alley where it belonged. And so in the 1920s, you have H.L. Mencken and his partner Nathan have created a Smart Set magazine, and they're not really making any money on it. So they need a side project to make cash. And so Nathan goes off to found Black Mask magazine, and they start recruiting these writers. And so you have a couple early writers who are kind of just taking, John Carroll Daly is one of the originators, hardboiled form. And he really is not doing what we would call noir writing. He's taking the Western and updating it to just a kind of vicious, adventurer shows up and shoots bad guys until there are no more bad guys, which doesn't go away. It just becomes suspense writing later. So you think of Mickey Spillane in the 50s
right.
and Lee Child more recently at the Jack Reacher novels. They are in that vein. But then along comes Dashiell Hammett. Now, Dashiell Hammett, born 1894, so a few years older than Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and those guys from Baltimore, drops out of school as a young man, but he reads voraciously, reads everything. Gets a job working with the Pinkertons, and then he goes off to World War I, leaves after the war is over, joins the Pinkertons again, tries to rejoin the army, but he contracts tuberculosis, which he has to deal with for a long time. Early on, starts combating tuberculosis the way so many people did with alcohol, and becomes a pretty serious alcoholic. And that will be a pretty common refrain, Kirk, with some of these. But here we have a guy whose early stories he starts publishing in Black Mask magazine are a revolution. And you have an unnamed character called the Continental Op, short for operative, who is, instead of tall, good-looking, cool, he is short, balding, pudgy, middle-aged. He often loses the fights when they're fought fairly, so he tries to cheat when he can. He's often solves crimes, not because he's smart, but because he knows a guy in the racket he can go talk to. He's his friends with cops, but he's also friends with bad guys. There's a certain code of conduct where they all operate according to this code. And these things were just changed how everyone saw it. And although Hammett and Hemingway start writing at exactly the same time, those similar backgrounds of Hemingway having been in the Red Cross and, of course, working as a reporter, and Hammett having been this detective, writing detective reports, where it's all about sparse and to the point and just the facts. They have very similar styles in some ways. They're different. There's a poetic streak in Hemingway that Hammett lacks. There's a laconic, sarcastic edge to some of Hammett's better writing that isn't always there in Hemingway. But they do come along in parallel lines in a way. And so finally, he starts writing these longer novellas, and those novellas are serialized novels. And so the first two books, Red Harvest and The Dane Curse, are about this Continental Op character. They are a little uneven. You can see where the seams joined, where these novellas he published in Black Mask.
Very, very episodic.
Very episodic. So it's easy to break the Dane Curse down into three sections. And I think Red Harvest breaks into three or four sections.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is a lack of sentimentality, a lack of romanticism that is just so refreshing compared to what everyone had been doing up till now. And it completely changes Black Mask magazine and where everything is going.
One of Hammett's contemporaries was Earl Stanley Gardner, who invented Perry Mason. And Hammett had just a huge influence on him. So those of you who only know Perry Mason through Raymond Burr, you know, are in for a surprise to go back and read some of those stories and see how dark they actually are. But yeah, the rise of Black Mask. Now, tell us a little bit about the background of that magazine. You mentioned it was a Mencken and George Dean Nathan publication. You also mentioned John Carroll Daly, and I have to say that maybe his most interesting contribution to the genre was the Ku Klux Klan story that that he did in 1923, which is pretty interesting. One of the things I like about hard-boiled fiction is it tends to engage with history or background a little bit more. So in the case of Red Harvest, Hammett's first novel, you know, it has a lot of dealings with labor strikes and sort of it creates this notion that a particular city, they call it Poisonville in the novel, is just seething with corruption. And it's a great opportunity for writers to get in there and look at the ways that the cities can be turned into characters and the way that bureaucracies promote corruption. And everybody's dirty in these novels.
Right.
There are no heroes.
Right.
The best you can be in a hard-boiled novel is compromised.
Well, and it's funny because you really see how the 20s, these stories start showing the corruption before the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, but they seem to clearly, in a way that more straightforward literary modernism does not, point to the crash and say, this is what's coming.
Yeah.
You cannot have everyone trying to gouge everyone else in this kind of, I don't know, ongoing love fest with, you know, gangster capitalism, to you know, reference other podcasts for a second, but and not have it have an impact on people, which is partly the Great Depression. And so in many ways, along we covered Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and we've looked at, you know, Fitzgerald and Hemingway. But in many ways, if you're looking for your Depression writers, these hard-boiled writers from the 30s are really showing you another side of it. It's very important as well. Now, one of the things, Kirk, I think is very interesting is in his fourth novel, The Glass Key, which is also a little bit episodic, and again was serialized in Black Mask. And to go back to your question, a guy named Cap Shaw takes over editing. Mm-hmm. And he teams up with Hammett and he says, this is what we need.
Right.
And so when writers, and he creates that Black Mask style of quick, hard, no frills, to the point. And he kind of told everyone, write like Hammett until Chandler came around. And then he said, okay, write like Hammett or Chandler.
Yeah.
And this one magazine just had a huge impact on the development of the noir form. But one of the things, to go back to my point, that Hammett did in The Glass Key is this is a novel about political corruption and in a city where all the democratic machines of the city, or the political party machines, are associated with various criminal organizations, which is actually very true in many large cities, including Chicago and New York of the 20s and 30s. And he does these things that are very interesting from a noir standpoint. The point of view is so remote, third person, that you almost don't know anything anyone is thinking internally. The main character is referred to as Ed Beaumont, or Ned Beaumont, excuse me, the entire time through. We're never told his first name or last name by itself. It's always both names. And you notice 8 years later, Hemingway does the same thing in For Whom the Bell Tolls. It's always Robert Jordan, never Robert or Jordan. Now, in that novel, Hemingway very much does free and direct discourse from Joyce, where he jumps into the third person point of view of the character. Whereas here, we're completely isolated from it. So it means you don't really know what the characters are going to do. But famously, it's not about a detective. It's about criminals.
Right.
And about trying to get away with things. So it's still a bit of a detective story, but we see a move. And there's a kind of fracture in hardboiled literature that, when we start talking about James M. Cain, is important. Sometimes it's a detective story, which basically means there's a crime to be solved, and we have a character or two trying to figure out what's going on. But sometimes in crime fiction, it's not about solving the crime. It's about getting away with the crime, surviving the crime. And maybe our great writer for that, who comes along just a few years after Hammett, is James M. Cain. Now, he's an interesting guy.
Handle just automobile insurance or all kinds?
All kinds. Fire, earthquake, theft, public liability, group insurance, industrial stuff, and so on right down the line.
Accident insurance?
Accident insurance? Sure, Mrs. Dietrichson. Would you tell me what's engraved on that anklet?
Just my name.
As for instance?
Phyllis.
Phyllis, huh? I think I like that.
But you're not sure?
I'd have to drive it around the block a couple of times.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
Classic writer. I think most people probably know him from the first book, The Postman Always Rings Twice, which is a great title. A little bit of trivia. The title came because he was trying to get it in the mail, if I remember the story correctly. And basically somebody told him he missed the chance and the postman never rings twice. So if you're looking for the postman to show up in that novel, it never does. One particular element, and I think this is one of the things that's great about that novel, is you always have to have a femme fatale.
Right.
In noir, hard-boiled fiction. So the representation of women in these stories is always very interesting. They're usually either gangster molls or, you know, wives who are angry at their husbands who end up killing them, or simply double-crossing women. And it creates, it feeds on this notion, I think, that is very prevalent in the Depression era, that men were somehow beset by the political conditions of the times, that the lack of economic opportunity was demeaning masculinity. And so women become the target of a lot of this violence or a lot of this culpability.
You know, there's some interesting feminist writing on this because, sure, on the other hand, these femme fatale characters are highly empowered.
Right.
And they're agents of their own fate rather than simply have, you know, objects of violence. And I wonder if a lot of this starts simply because up until now, the cliche is a damsel in distress, which is not to say you wouldn't have women murderers in Doyle or Christie, although none come to mind off the top of my head, who are at least isolated women murderers as opposed to part of a cabal. But in The Maltese Falcon, which becomes this huge bestseller and truly cements the idea of the hard-boiled private eye with Sam Spade, there the femme fatale starts off pretending to be the woman in distress, the damsel, and very clearly Spade, who is so suspicious and skeptical and cynical, but does really like her, figures out what's going on with her. And I'm not going to give any spoilers away. The film adaptation is very close to the book. And that's when Howard Hawks let John Huston take the book rights away from him. And then Huston had been working for Hawks. Hawks says, here's my advice. Just film it as it's written. Don't change a thing. And it's just what Huston did. So maybe that Miss Wonderly character is one of her nicknames in the novel. Maybe she has such an impact that helps create the femme fatale, but it becomes such a trope. And Postman Always Rings Twice, when they filmed that with Lana Turner, and I guess this is something we should say as an aside, it's hard to talk about the great novels of roman noir without talking about the movie adaptations of film noir, because certainly his two best novels are also two of the great films of that time.
Right.
You know, Postman Always Rings Twice with Lana Turner, and Double Indemnity with Fred McMurray and Barbara. Oh, it's right off the top of my head.
Stanwyck.
Barbara Stanwyck. Thank you. A Big Valley fame for those.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to mention that.
Grew up in the 70s, like
Yes.
Kirk and I did that. That yes. Western was on every afternoon
with Lee Majors and Linda Evans.
Right.
Oh my gosh. That cracks me up that you mentioned that. That is my childhood
How could
there.
I not mention the big Valley?
Well, don't forget too Mildred Pierce with Joan.
And Mildred
Crawford.
Pierce, which is right, made into a good film in the 40s and filmed again not too long ago.
Yeah, about
into
15 years
good,
ago.
A good adaptation then.
Kate Winslet. Yeah. Who did a fabulous job. Actually, a much more faithful
adaptation
more recently. The other thing I would note about, and we'll get to some of these authors here in a little bit, but sometimes the movies themselves, because they have the star power of Humphrey Bogart or somebody like that, they overshadow the novels completely.
Right.
And so some of these movies, because they were made by Otto Preminger or, you know,
Billy Wilder.
They linger in the memory longer than the novels. And we have to go back and recover the novels and give due diligence to the ways that the book versions are, in many cases, I think, a lot more interesting.
Right.
I did want to go to, if I could, I just wanted to ask you one quick question about the representation of crime in here. One of the challenges that I have with some of these novels is there is a point where the criminals become so stylized and some of the language becomes so stylized that it passes over from being realism into being almost the way that I describe it to my students is going from a intense sort of realistic crime movie into kind of Steven Seagal territory, you know, where it just seems almost a little campy. And, you know, Hammett invented this idea that you always have a metaphor for violence or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, they never shoot a gun. They're spitting lead or something like that.
Right.
And the slang sometimes can get so... The slang can sometimes get so over the top, it detracts from the realism. And same way with, you know, with the gangsters' names, you know, Hammett has a tendency, you know, to have characters' names like the Snake or the, something like that. It takes away just a little bit. Now, I will say in the Maltese Falcon, he has some of the greatest criminals ever because they just seem very human.
The Fat Man. Yeah, Casper Gutt. Well, the Fat Man's name.
Casper Gutt.
Is Gutman, you know,
Gutman,
so it's a little bit obvious. Yeah, I guess probably we need to remember that those early Black Mass stories are pulp fiction.
Yeah,
their goal is people are churning out stories, you know, by the word, by the week. You didn't have television, radio serials had not caught on yet, and this is what the readership of America wanted if they wanted crime writing. They wanted something every week that would just be quick and short, and you got to have introduce situation, have some violence, resolve situation. It would be the modern equivalent to be like writing for weekly television episodes, where a 20 episode a year serial television show.
Let me ask you this, Scott. Out of the four popular genres that kind of dominate in this era, romance fiction, westerns, the rising interest in science fiction, and detective fiction, why do you think detective fiction is the one whose popularity has never really waned over the years? Now, people still love romance fiction, but it gets very little serious due. I would argue that science fiction is only in recent years getting the attention it deserves. And while the Western has never really gone away, it's certainly not as prevalent. And it tends to be talked about kind of in a nostalgic way, I think.
Right. So briefly on science fiction, I think you spend so much time in a short story setting up the world and the circumstance, it interferes with the art.
Right.
And so there are many great science fiction short stories and novellas. You really have to have a novel for it to still be pretty literary successful. And that comes later. But and with romance fiction, if it's really perfectly executed and very well done, even if it has a happy ending, it's not going to be classified as romance fiction. It's going to be classified as literary fiction. So it jumps the genre traces just by virtue of being really well told. So Jane Eyre is on the one hand gothic, on the other hand is romantic, but you know, it's a romance novel with a happy ending.
Yeah. Well, Great Gatsby is a romance novel, but
yeah,
I'm one of
The tragic ending, I think, stops the...
I'm one of the people that has argued it's actually a proto-hardboiled novel in some ways.
he definitely knows what's going on with Black Mass Magazine. And of course, we know that Hemingway's reading Hammett. He references it in Green Hills of Africa.
Right.
I think they're reading The Dane Curse while they're in
Africa.
He
owns a copy of The Dane Curse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably the weakest of Hammett's original string of novels.
Yeah, it probably is, although there are brilliant moments in it. And he does have a writer named Fitzstevens, who's a bad guy, you know. So
one of the interesting legacies of him and the Dane Curse is there's Ross McDonald, who later did the Lou Archer novels, is a huge fan of this too. There's always like a cult leader, some kind of weird, you know, guru figure that comes into these novels.
Ross McDonald copies that probably 8 or 9 times in those Lou Archer novels. And even Chandler does a little bit in one of his.
Yeah.
So did it really go back to your question? I think part of it is it still exists in the world around us. There is crime in the world around us. There is corruption. So it's less an exercise of suspension of disbelief. It's less an exercise of imagination where you have to pretend people can fly, or we have faster than light travel, or there's a fantasy world where you have jetpacks. You don't have to put you don't have to look for, or you don't have to account for all those things.
Right.
Instead, you can just take something that you've heard about or something you know about. I mean, when Hammett and Chandler and Kane are hitting it in the 20s and 30s, think about the daily news in Chicago, the assassinations, the killings, the arrest of, you know, think of the, you know, Bugsy Siegel is heading out to Vegas. I guess that's a little later when that happens. But Capone's gang, Luciano, Schultz, Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd. I mean, there's a lot of crime going on in the United States in the years right before the Depression and through the Depression. I mean, there's a reason that the other term we use for the 20s is the Roaring 20s because of the rise of organized crime. And of course, our famous Hoover head of the FBI says, oh, there's no such thing as an organized crime or mafia in the United States, until he finally, I guess, had to recant. Briefly, to go back to Kane for one second, Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
He is he's a newspaper writing and editor. He too is involved in H.L. Mencken, and he's a writer and editor for the American Mercury. He's a managing editor of the New Yorker for a year, which I had not known before we started researching for this episode. And James Thurber and E.B. White worked under him at The New Yorker.
Yeah, interesting.
He goes to Hollywood to be a screenwriter based on his stories and articles before he starts writing novels, and he can't cut it as a screenwriter. So he's actually, instead of it being the writer who gets pulled out to Hollywood to write screenplays, we have a guy who fails at being a screenplay writer and turns to writing novels.
Yeah.
And that's where, of course, a lot of his irritation with the rich and important people comes from. I think he really strikes a chord there.
We also have the fact, and I think we can use this as a segue to get into Chandler a little bit, but we also have a fixation when we talk about the cities. There is no greater noir city than Los Angeles.
Right.
And a lot of Lou Archer is there, and you know, Sam Spade is San Francisco, and the Continental Op is usually Baltimore, or some, in the case of Red Harvest, in Montana.
Right.
But there's a fascination with Hollywood in a lot of these novels, and with Southern California, and the idea of paradise as an illusion beneath which lies, you know, the worms and the rot and sort of everything that it takes meticulously to create that elaborate veneer. And people may think of the fantastic movie Chinatown. That is kind of the ultimate pastiche, if you want to call it.
Right.
Of all of this hard-boiled fiction.
Right. And it's weird because everyone always assumes Chinatown must be based on a novel, and it's not, but it is based on real Los Angeles history.
Yeah.
To a degree.
Yep.
See me?
So you're a private detective. I didn't know they existed except in books, or else they were greasy little men snooping around hotel corridors. Ah, you're a mess, aren't you?
I'm not very tall either.
Next time I'll come on stilts, wear a white tie and carry a tennis racket.
I doubt if even that would help. Now, this business of Dad's, think you can handle it for him?
It shouldn't be too tough.
Really? I would have thought a case like that took a little effort.
Not too much.
What will your first step be?
The usual one.
I didn't know there was a usual one.
Oh, sure there is. It comes complete with diagrams on page 47 of how to be a detective and 10 easy lessons, correspondence school textbook, and your father offered me a drink.
You must have read another one on how to be a comedian.
Hear what I said about the drink?
I'm quite serious, Mr. Marlowe. My father's not...
Father...
Help yourself. Now, look, Mr. Marlowe. My father's not well, and I want this case handled with the least possible worry to him.
That's just the way I was going to handle it.
I see. No professional secrets.
No.
I thought you wanted a drink.
I changed my mind.
Then what? How did you like Dad?
I liked him.
He liked Sean. Sean Regan. I suppose you'll know who he is.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to play poker with me, Mr. Marlowe. Dad wants to find him, doesn't he?
Do you?
Of course I do. Wasn't right for him to go off like that. Broke Dad's heart, although he won't say much about it. Or did he?
Why don't you ask him?
You know, I don't see what there is to be cagey about, Mr. Marlowe. And I don't like your manners.
Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me.
People don't talk to me like that.
Oh.
So Chandler's a very interesting case, and he's got an Irish mother who marries an alcoholic father who's really bad for them. He's born in Chicago. He lived there a few years, and in Nebraska a few years. And these are two places I never associate Chandler with. So when he's 12, she moves him to England to get away from the bad situation in the States. And she's remarried. They're in Croydon. He's educated at Dulwich College, works as a journalist. And before World War I, moves back to the United States in the early part of the 19-teens, work as a bookkeeper. But as World War I comes out and goes on for a little while, he joins the Canadian Expeditionary Force. Famously, he's part of a group that is blasted to pieces. He's one of the few survivors of his company. So in his 2.5 years or so of service, they're a pretty brutal time. So he's got this in common, of course, with James M. Cain and Hammett. He's a World War I veteran. And you see this with a whole lot of these writers at this time. Comes back and works for the oil syndicate. But the drinking gets worse. His absenteeism, because he hates it, gets worse. So he starts writing stories on the side because his job is precarious. He's also looking to marry this much older woman, and his mother is breaking the marriage, you know, won't let him do it. But finally he does, and he's married to this woman, Sissy, who's like, I think, 14 years older than him for the rest of his life till she dies and until he
seems much older in their photographs with each other. Yes. Right.
And there's always some speculation he's looking for another mother with that. But like Cain, like Hammett, he's dealing with alcoholism, but he starts breaking into Black Mask magazine, and immediately his stories show this guy's operating on a different level than everyone. And if you're choosing one writer of the classic noir period who bridges the gap into literary fiction best, and everyone else kind of comes second, it's indisputably Raymond Chandler.
Yeah.
He's just firing on all cylinders. There's a level of character complexity. He challenges the stereotypes. He goes against them in his novels. The film versions often actually have to go back and add a lot more cliche to the stories because they're not cliche enough for the film versions. But a lot of the early novels are like Hammett. They're joining together novellas and stories. And Chandler was not super prolific. He only wrote 7 novels, and one of them was really, he wrote as a screenplay and he rewrote his novel, his last one. He always called it cannibalizing his fiction, but that really the seams don't show in Chandler the way they do.
Yeah.
Hammett, the stories, although the plots are so complicated,
Byzantine.
Yeah. No one cares because the writing is so good. The characters are so well crafted. And again, you know, the urban landscape is a landscape of corruption.
Yeah.
The cops are often corrupt. Not always. There's always a few good ones around. The city officials are often corrupt, you know, big time. The mafia or the organized crime, the gambling syndicate, the rackets all have their thumbs and everything.
The drug dealers.
Right. Drug dealers. And here we have Marlowe, who's a shop-soiled Galahad.
Yeah.
And one of the things so Hammett has 2 books about the Continental Op, one about Nick Charles, one about Sam Spade, one about Ned Beaumont. But here's Chandler. All his novels are about Philip Marlowe. And the stories are about different characters, and you can see how he's trying them out. And Marlowe's name is based on Mallory, as well as Christopher Marlowe. but Sir Thomas Mallory, you know, with the King Arthur stories and this idea of kind of chivalry. In the opening scene of The Big Sleep, he's looking at a knight staring at a maiden tied to a tree and about to untie her. And Marlowe says, I don't think he was trying hard enough, and I stuck around, I'd have to get up there and help him untie her. And that idea of this kind of long, you know, the character in Hamlet is a professional who works for an agency.
Yeah. It's just a job to him.
It's just a job. His ethics are professional ethics.
Mm-hmm.
In Marlowe's case, he's a lone wolf. And this is, of course, what all the private eyes are going to copy after this. And no one can buy him. He doesn't stay bought. You buy his loyalty by being his friend, or he likes you romantically. And he does have the femme fatale characters, but he also goes against that as well, because very often the femme fatales are victims, or they're women who are fighting back against that kind of label. So you have the two sisters in The Big Sleep, and one of which is initially seems to be that kind of character and is exactly the opposite of it. And then the other one is a little more troubled than that. And so you see him mess with these cliches. And interestingly, The Long Goodbye, although it is about partly a love story between Marlowe and the woman he meets will be the love interest into the next novel, it's also about his friendship with the guy who, in that case, the femme fatale is the man.
Yeah.
It's the guy who kind of betrays his trust and works against him.
It's like, it's the ultimate, you violated the bro code.
Yeah.
Type novel.
Yeah. You, you know, you set me up. I took the fall for you. And well, we're giving spoilers here, but it doesn't really matter what order you read these in, although playback should probably be read after The Long Goodbye.
Yeah.
But he hits with The Big Sleep in 39. Here's another interesting thing for you, Kurt. Marlowe kills two or three people in The Big Sleep. And in the novels, and there's a couple of short stories where he kills someone, he never shoots anyone again for the entire rest of the book series.
That's a great point. I have to tell you, my favorite, I recognize the importance of The Big Sleep, and it's a great novel to teach, but I have to tell you that my favorite is his second novel, Farewell, My Lovely. You mentioned his sort of interest in, you know, medievalism and the way he created Marlowe into a knight-errant type figure. But he's also a huge Shakespearean. And
yeah.
I think his interest in the past, almost like T.S. Eliot in a weird way, gave him a sense that the modern world was a wasteland and that, you know, we had to kind of shore these ruins of our morality together. Much more cynical and sarcastic, maybe not cynical, but sarcastic. But there's definitely a code. And, you know, this whole notion in crime literature where even the best of the criminals say that a man's got to have a code.
Right.
That all comes from Chandler.
Yeah. Yeah, because the code in Hammett is really the code of professional ethics of the detective.
Yeah.
And you've taken someone's money, so let's, you know, we have to be true to it.
And all that. A lot of the gangster novels that start in the late 20s and then, you know, kind of transmute into the other version of crime figures where it's the leaders, the Caesars, the little Caesars and the, you know, kind of the Al Capone figures. That is capitalism run amok. The gangster novels are a sort of weird hyper appreciation of capitalism to where they're just making money off things that are illegal.
Right.
And that's what America is all about.
Now, Chandler also writes some pretty great screenplays. So not only does Chandler become super successful because of a wonderful adaptation of The Big Sleep by William Faulkner and Lee Brackett for Howard Hawks, but he also works on Double Indemnity with Billy Wilder on Kane's great novel, Blue Dahlia, which stars Alan Ladd, who we see him as kind of a small little waifish guy. You think of him in Shane and the contrast, and now he's so tough, but it's in spite of his stature. So it's hard to think he was actually a lead in all these hard-boiled novels before, or hard-boiled films before that. But he also writes Strangers on a Train, which Hitchcock will adapt from one of the writers we'll talk about in a little bit. But so far, Kurt, it should be no surprise to anyone that the world of hard-boiled writing is a boys' club up to this point.
Yeah.
But as we start getting into the World War II era, along comes a woman who wants to break it up a little bit and introduce herself, and she does so very successfully, and that would be?
This is Dorothy B. Hughes, and we mentioned a little bit ago that some of the writers that get overlooked because the film adaptations are so important. I think she's a perfect example of this as a writer who was kind of forgotten for many years, but has been sort of brought back into print in the past maybe 20, 30 years. Dorothy P. Hughes is a very interesting figure. A lot of her work is set in New Mexico, and that gives her as a setting a whole different area to explore. So one of her novels that people celebrate a lot. She basically she wrote 8 or 9, but she's mainly remembered for 3. So Ride a Pink Horse in 1946 is a very important one, and that was made into a film a few years later as well. The great thing about that one is that it's sort of built around a festival. It's called the festival, actually. And it's an event annually in Santa Fe that celebrates the Spanish reconquest of New Mexico in 1692. So it gives a whole carnivalesque element to the presentation of the novel. But the thing I love about Ride a Pink Horse is it's almost like the glass key. It's a novel about political favors.
Yeah.
And the whole premise is this fixer kind of comes back into a life of a senator. And, you know, we know the senator has committed a crime, if not more crimes. And basically this character who's known only as Sailor wants to get paid off. The great thing about all of these novels where you start having the criminal element or the blackmail, it starts to feel like where you have a feeling in the detective fiction that at least if the crime is going to go unpunished, at least there is a recognition of who the criminal is.
Right.
But in these novels about the criminals, there's a real sense that, you know, fate may be a bitch. Fate may not work out well. And so there's a lot of obstacles to these criminals having to overcome reversals and double crosses. And
right.
It just exposes to you how really deliriously mean and venal the world is.
Yeah, there's definitely a streak of literary naturalism when we look
exactly.
at
exactly. Yeah.
You know, the whole point of the hardboiled detective novels, you still have a sense of agency and ability to control events and your fate through the detective. But in the more crime-based novels, they're more at the whim of the circumstances around them. I think in her book, the one I'm most familiar with, and I've only read a couple of them, I have to admit, but most of them are not in print, so they're hard to find.
Yeah.
In a Lonely Place, which is a very good film that has almost nothing to do with the novel.
I know. They really, I mean, this is kind of the dilemma that Hollywood is in this era, because this is still the code era. I mean, we still have 20 years of the code era to go.
The Hayes Production Code.
Exactly.
Criminals don't win. People don't sleep together in a way that unless you can piece together what it means when it fades to black.
And you can understand. I mean, I'm not sure we want a movie in which, as happens in the novel version, that the Humphrey Bogart character, whose name is Dick Steele, turns out to be a serial killer.
Right.
You know, that would kind of dampen our ability to appreciate Casablanca and all of the other great Humphrey Bogart movies. But In a Lonely Place is a wonderful exploration of Los Angeles again. And you can really feel this is where we get into novelists sort of exploring sort of the ability of criminals to fake their connection to reality and to suppress their sociopath instincts.
Yeah.
You know, in earlier novels like the Kane one about the postman always rings twice, the main character is usually kind of a fop or a downtrodden guy who's tricked into some or seduced into some sort of crime, and everything goes wrong for him. But with In a Lonely Place and some other examples that we're looking at, there's just a real sense of the ability of amoral people to fake their place in society and to mask. It's almost proto Bret Easton Ellis, the American, what's his novel about the serial killer, Patrick?
American Psycho.
American Psycho, exactly.
And then just that whole, the sociopath next door. Remember when that book was a big fad with all the book clubs?
Yep.
And it's really interesting because she really paves the way, I think you could argue, what she's doing in A Lonely Place, which comes out, I think, in 1947,
right,
paves the way for what so many other crime writers are going to do. In fact, one of the writers I'm going to talk about, Jim Thompson, is completely, and for that matter, Patricia Highsmith.
I was going to say Highsmith, definitely.
Are completely dwelling in that same space.
Let me mention one more Dorothy Hughes novel that I think is important that was just brought into print, back into print about 10 years ago. It's a very timely book for two reasons. It's called The Expendable Man. It came out in 1963. It was actually her last novel. And it is about a black doctor who is accused of being an abortionist.
Ah.
So he has to kind of track down this is one of the interesting things that happens is how these classic formula of noir fictions of the 30s and 40s adapt to changing times. And very often the film versions do not adapt to the 60s well. There is a
right.
There is a Marlowe starring James Garner before the Rockford Files that is actually just kind of painful to watch because
yeah.
he looks so Marlowe looks so out of place in the world that he's being
or Robert Altman, who just changes everything to fit
and I know that
Hollywood movie
his version of The Long Goodbye, a lot of people love it, but I just cannot get into it.
I have to assume those people have never read the book and have no affection for the novel.
It's almost dissociation to me.
Yeah.
and I just find Elliot Gould very irritating in that role.
I could not agree more. We are 100% in consensus on that.
So The Expendable Man really captures, I think, the civil rights era and that sense of racism. She was a white writer. So she's doing something I don't think you could do today, which is to write in voice of a black person if you're a white writer. But she really does capture that sense of the boundary. And I think on the surface, it's maybe not as dramatic a novel in terms of betrayals and all of this kind of stuff, because, what's at risk here is he's got to find the reason why a hitchhiker that he picked up is found later dead in a canal. And, everybody is just willing to pin it on him because he's black.
That is, of course, one of the things that makes it such an electric idea is everyone's prejudices is already completely salted the jury and paved the way all the way through.
And the great thing about it is there is none of the sort of To Kill a Mockingbird type sentimentalizing of racial relations in the novel. I think she captures really well the utter fear that black people may have felt of being accused of a crime, especially in the, in the years after Emmett Till.
Right. Now, there's also Hughes's work points us to another woman crime writer, detective writer.
Right.
And I have to confess that although you have taught her, I only know this woman from the wonderful adaptation of one of her books. So tell us about Vera Caspary, Kirk.
Well, Vera Caspary did something very unique where she kind of initiated the genre of crime fiction that kind of blended noir and romance fiction.
Mm.
And the novel in question is Laura, which, as you mentioned, was made into a movie by Otto Preminger, who was very shocking, condescending toward the author, and who tweaked a number of details in the movie version to really to placate his own whims, I think.
Right.
But Laura is a great book because I think you can go in there, and one of the neat things about it is it's told from different perspectives. So it's almost like you, the reader, are the detective and you're taking testimony from each of these characters. We do have a detective figure who comes into the novel, but we also have other suspects, and it's a lot of fun. It's also feels very adaptable to the stage because the main space that we are located in is Laura's apartment,
right,
where a dead body is found, and the question is who is the culprit. One of the neat things about the novel is it gives us a very memorable character in the form of her neighbor named Waldo Ledecker, who
right.
is I always imagined him being played by the guy who plays Dr. Smith on Lost in Space. He kind of has that sort of effeminate foppishness, that sort of effete.
Well, you know, the film version is Vincent Price, who's
right.
very similar.
Yeah.
To that same actor who plays the Lost in Space guy.
That sort of aristocratic mean, which is fake. You can
Right.
tell it's fake, but it also doesn't seem very threatening until it becomes threatening.
Right.
It also has elements of psychological suspense in that there's a portrait of Laura that plays prominently in the plot that people are fixated with, almost like the picture of Dorian Gray.
She had quite a career publishing novels up through the 70s, so it's interesting that she isn't given more credit for breaking through at this point.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things you discover is really women's crime fiction, women's detective fiction, shocking as it is, except for the one major exception that you're going to talk about, really does not take off until the hard-boiled women's crime fiction does not necessarily take off until the early 80s with the emergence of people like Sarah Paretsky. Sarah Paretsky is given huge, with V.I. Warshawski, is given huge credit for sort of igniting,
right,
or bringing women to the
hard-boiled side.
Exactly.
And we should mention that the classic side, which also is sometimes called the cozy domestic because
right.
of lack of violence and killings are done very much in a non-gruesome way. So someone's poisoned or they, you know, or they're gassed or
strangled
or something falls and squishes them, but you don't see any corpse or anything. There are a lot of very popular women writers in that category. The most famous of whom, of course, is Agatha Christie, and probably the best of them is Dorothy Sayers,
right?
Who, like Chandler, like Hammett, kind of, even as she's perfecting the genre, is kind of messing with it and pulling its strings as well and doing some interesting things from a feminist standpoint with some of her characters.
But you can also see how women writers were a little bit stereotyped into that.
Absolutely.
Into that particular genre, with almost the presumption of, you know, the dirty world of crime is a
just
little
for the boys. Yeah.
Offset. But that's not the case with Patricia Highsmith.
No, and Highsmith is operating on she's coming a little later than our other writers we've been writing about, and is born in 21. Her parents divorced before she's even born. And then her mother ends up with a stepfather, and the mother and she never get along. Now, to be fair to her mother, it seems like Patricia Highsmith never got along with anyone.
With anybody.
She's had such a problem living with her mother and stepfather that she's raised partly by her grandmother in Fort Worth, Texas. She does make it to Barnard College. And this is another cool factoid I found out doing a little research here, Kirk, is she worked as a comic book writer for several years, working on crime comics, war comics, romance comics, Western comics. Like these other guys, she dealt with depression and alcoholism. She also dealt with anorexia. She's famous for having liked animals way more than she liked people. Most of her biographers and people who write about her would typically characterize her as a lesbian, although she slept with a fair number of men, and she wrote novels about lesbian sexuality and lesbian life under a pen name. And it seems pretty clear she preferred sleeping with them. But the weird thing is she didn't like women. So people referred to her as a lesbian misogynist. And most of her better friends were men. She seems like she didn't have a whole lot of friends. But she writes Strangers on a Train about the two guys, famously, who decide to off each other's spouses to get out from under their circumstances. One of them regrets it, and then he's going up against a sociopath. And then where she really hits her stride is in 1955, which is her fourth novel. I think second novel under her name, third novel overall, The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Mr. Ripley.
Which, just introduces a complete sociopath with very overt homoerotic tones, although she doesn't, you know, openly necessarily characterize him as gay in that first novel. And who basically sets out, at first he's kind of in love with the guy, then he kills him and just takes over his life. And it's all about staying a step ahead of the authorities, manipulating people, taking the fact that he's completely amoral and using that as his primary weapon to become a successful, eventually, con man and thief. What's interesting is people talk about a Ripley series. So other writers who have detective series or crime series, you'll have the same character every year or every other year. She doesn't return to Ripley until 15 years later in 1970. And then she leaves him alone again, comes back 4 years later. then leaves him alone again and comes back 6 years after that. And then finally, 11 years later. So, you know, it's five books over a 35-year period. So she's not just kind of cranking them out. But again, we have a writer who just refused to kind of play by the rules, who did what she wanted to do, who's really firing on all cylinders in terms of her writing style, the clarity of the prose. And people are just really fascinated by a lot of her work.
Yeah, I teach The Two Faces of January quite a bit, which is actually one that's set in Europe. Part of what she would write about is she would take these characters with, you know, sort of same-sex inclinations and really create neat sort of emotional dependencies between them. You usually have one that is the younger, sort of more desirous one glomming on to one that is, for lack of a better word, more straight, more secure, more settled. But it's a game, it's a sort of game of mental manipulation between these types of figures. And interestingly enough, the women who are in the periphery of this tend to be the victims of this sort of male masochism that goes on. I should mention, though, that another novel of hers has recently been rediscovered called Deep Water, that was made into a movie this past year with Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas, who's in the Maryland movie right now. It got panned pretty hard. It's an Adrian Lynch movie, and that's the guy who did Fatal Attraction. So,
right.
And again, what we have here are sort of men, male characters who are so insecure or masochistic in their security of their masculinity that it really does some interesting gender stuff with our ideas of what is male and what is effeminate.
So here then we have what Dorothy Hughes has done with crime writing, what Patricia Highsmith has done with crime writing. And that's going to take us into, I think, the one who stylistically is James M. Cain's successor and heir, but who thematically is following right behind Patricia Highsmith, and that's Jim Thompson.
Right.
Thompson's work, when you read his best stuff, his first couple of books are literary novels, which just do not really work all that well in comparison. But boy, Thompson grows up in Oklahoma, works on the oil fields, like a lot of people who have a rough time in working class environments in the 30s, including Dorothy Hughes and including Dashiell Hammett and Vera Caspary. He flirts with communism until the witch hunts of the 50s scare them all away. And we should give Hammett credit because it didn't scare him away. He confronted them in actual court and was thrown in jail for refusing to cooperate with Congress. And they said, what book should people be reading? He said, if I were you, I wouldn't want anyone to read at all because they might think for themselves. But when he hits it with his crime writing, The Killer Inside Me, about a guy who's giving in to being a serial killer and who's trying to cover his crimes. And then also just the hard-boiled novels, The Getaway, which is a great crime novel about a bunch of...
I think that's probably my favorite of his.
Yeah. The Grifters, great stuff. He has a tendency to kind of go back to the well with the serial killer thing. Pop 1280 is another, you know, horrible title, but great book. But boy, they're all writing at just kind of a tour de force. I mean, terse, first person, hard boiled writing. And just if you're really looking for just two or three, After Dark, My Sweet, and The Getaway, The Grifters would be a great trio.
One of the reasons I really love The Getaway is that you go through about two thirds of it where there are all these sort of double crosses on a bank robbery, and there's a sort of fleeing to get out to California to get to Mexico. But then once you get to Mexico, it takes you into this very surreal place called El Rey, which is funny because that's the name of my favorite bar in Montgomery. But it's also sort of this weird resort where criminals are able to come and hide, run by a woman named Ma Santos. And the novel just gets so very surreal and almost allegorical that you're thinking, where are we? And of course, what's happening is you have this couple, Doc and I think is her name Carol? Is that my memory? You're basically wondering, you know, which of these two is going to kill the other, because because you know that this marriage is not going to survive. The Getaway was made into a famous, famous Sam Peckinpah movie with Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw, but it did not. It cuts off before they go to El Rey, so it's a little, little deceptive in that way.
It's another case of the hard boiled work is too hard boiled for Hollywood.
But man, I mean, I love that book and I love that movie almost for diametrical reasons.
It's one of the things that's so great about so many of these books is very often the films, even though they change things a lot, are still great. But you are missing things if you only go with the film. It's worth seeing them, and also, but you have to read them, really.
The movie version of The Grifters, I should mention, too, that came out in 1990 with Angelica Houston and John Cusack is brilliant as well. I mean, that is so... And that's one where you also get a sense of another theme of Thompson's, where there's a kind of weird incestual motif that runs through a lot of his male characters, where they're looking at mothers and older women with a very disturbing sort of perspective.
You know, the regular literary landscape throughout the 50s and 60s, we have the Freudianism is amok, and everyone in the big cities has a therapist. And it's all about their sexual hangups. And you've got the Alfred Kinsey reports going on. And then, of course, we're leading into eventually the discovery of the pill and in Summer of Free Love in 67. So all that kind of bundled up energy really shows up in interesting and weird ways in these hard-boiled crime novels of the 40s and 50s, where they're really playing on a lot of these kind of Freudian notions.
And I think that's one of the difficulties that maybe contemporary readers might have with, like, Highsmith. I mean, she tends to attribute the male, you know, her male character's homosexual inclinations to the dominance of mothers or wives. I mean, it's a very, on one level, it's a very psychologically cliche sort of explanation for it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it doesn't make for great character vulnerabilities.
Right. Well, and even Tennessee Williams does that.
Sure.
You know, when you think about Blanche DuBois, well, she has the character has a gay husband who kills himself because she insults him. And she, in her way, thinks if only she was more sexual, then he'd have been saved, it wouldn't be dead, and so therefore she becomes a nymphomaniac. Yeah. It's a little trite, but it, you know, kind of works.
Well, you
in
have
play.
That in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof too, where I'm not sure there's much more of a homoerotic movie than that.
No, not until you get to the ones that are just openly, you know, staking their flag. Anyway, so we move then from Thompson, who's just doing this great work, to a kind of writer who I think has been almost forgotten, but people have been working hard to bring him back, who for a long time, I think probably a film adaptation of one of his novels was better known than his writing. And that's Horace McCoy. He's one of the other kind of undersung heroes of noir the 30s and 40s.
Well, McCoy's a fascinating figure. He resented the fact throughout his life that he was kind of categorized in the Kane school, as he called it. He was not a particular fan of James M. Cain, but I think that was probably his own sort of anger at the ups and downs of his career. Maybe the best way to think of Horace McCoy is he's kind of a noir version of Nathaniel West. I mean, there's a lot of great parallels between Miss Lonely Hearts and The Day of the Locust to McCoy's best known novel, which has one of the greatest titles ever. They Shoot Horses, Don't They? I mean, long before I ever saw that movie or read the book, I remember.
You remember that?
Well,
title?
I remember getting in trouble one time, and this is awful. In high school, because I was working on I had a little satire column in the school newspaper, and you know, being the outcast reject I was, I did a satire on the social mores of cheerleaders. And I titled it, They Shoot Cheerleaders, Don't They? Which I think maybe one faculty member got the reference. And, you know, in those days, people just hit the photo. This wasn't even the photocopier. It was the Ditto machine. And they printed this thing and it got around school. And of course, if that had happened today, I'd have been expelled, but it kind of flipped people out. And I kept saying it's an allusion to a movie title.
Yeah, it had been on social media, and your life would be over.
So,
well, and like Hughes's book that's set during a festival, this is set during a dance marathon for a big part of it.
It's a fascinating book. I mean, it's a short book. One of the neat things he does is he's very experimental in this regard, is he juxtaposes chapters around the delivery of the sentence of the main character,
right,
who you learn right from the opening that this guy Robert has shot Gloria, his dance partner, and you're kind of building up to figure out exactly why, but you know every short chapter is prefaced by the declaration from the judge, whose morality is just completely inapplicable to Robert's thinking. Maybe even a better way of thinking of it is this is kind of the pulp version of Camus' The Stranger. It has a lot of affinities with that.
Well, I very much believe if you don't have Hemingway and you don't have American hard-boiled detective writing, you don't have Camus.
And we should mention that a lot of these writers, when they're forgotten in America, it's the French, you know, the French
love this stuff.
Existential influenced writers who keep it going.
Well, and French literary critics who are writing serious criticism about these writers at a time when they're being ignored in America. Kirk and I make zero money for this podcast. In fact, it costs us a little bit of money. But I will tell you that the Library of America, which turns out these great hardback collections of books, has a wonderful book called Crime Novels, American Noir, the 1930s and 40s. And it's got Postman Always Rings Twice, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Edward Anderson, Thieves Like Us, Kenneth Fearing, The Big Clock,
which
is
a
fine book and a fine film. William Lindsay Gresham, Nightmare Alley, which just got turned into a movie with Bradley Cooper. And Cornell Woolrich, I Married a Dead Man. Cornell Woolrich is a famous noir writer who churned out books like crazy and who, I don't know how many times, started it with The Case of Amnesia.
Yeah.
I mean, probably 20 books start with Case of Amnesia.
It is amazing when you read a lot of books by these same authors that they can be incredibly repetitive in the way that they reuse devices and techniques. But I think that's because they were, like Jim Thompson, they were writing these books fast. You know, they're writing two or three books a year. They're
trying to make a living at it. Yeah,
exactly. And the pulp fiction market, you know, these are books that originally would be sold for a quarter, 50 cents, maybe at the most.
Yeah.
And that's a slog. That's a tough life.
You could argue a lot of this market exists because the paperback becomes so much more popular following World War II. Up until then, most books were published in hardback and paperbacks were fewer and harder to come by. And then suddenly everything changes. Our current mostly paperback, people wait for the paperback to get it cheaper and all that. That's all a post-World War II revolution in publishing. It's just a way of cost saving. Now, the next writer we want to talk about, maybe our final writer that we'll really go into, is Chester Himes. Chester Himes is unique among all these writers because he is a black man. So he grew up in Jefferson City, Missouri. Well, he's born in Jefferson City, Missouri, but raised for a while in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, deals with all the Jim Crow problems you would expect, including one that had a great lasting impact on him, where his brother is doing a kind of high school chemistry experiment at home. There's an explosion. He's blinded. They try taking him to hospital and they won't admit him because it's not the black part of the hospital or the black hospital. So it kind of builds a certain rage in him. They move to Cleveland. His parents split up. Time's a little rough. He gets into Ohio State, but he's expelled for a prank. And a year later, he's arrested for armed robbery, sentenced to hard labor for 20 to 25 years. But in prison, he's reading a lot, gets interested in all kinds of literature, and starts publishing things from prison and is paroled after only 6 years. Around this time, he meets Langston Hughes, who promotes him, kind of gets him into the literary establishment. We've talked before about how the Harlem Renaissance is a little bit of a kind of insider's club in terms of people helping each other, or in a case of like Richard Wright, we're going against Zora Neale Hurston blocking each other. But he does okay with a few literary novels, but they don't really get a big hit. The best of those would be If He Hollers, Let Him Go, which is a pretty good book. He goes to Los Angeles and tries to make it as a screenwriter, but the studio system just has so much racism built into it. He says, although it's not officially a Jim Crow system, it really was in culture, if not in law. And so he moves back east and eventually makes his way over to Paris, where he meets the critic Marcel Duchamp, who is one of those critics we're talking about, doing all that work on film noir and on literary noir, you know, goes on to Himes for a while about all these great crime writers he should be reading. And so Himes starts writing his Harlem Detective series. And so The Real Cool Killers comes out. Actually, the first book, Rage in Harlem, 57, originally publishes for Love of Isabel, which I got to think Rage in Harlem is a little bit better title. Then The Real Cool Killers in 59, Crazy Kill, 59, Big Gold Dream, all shot up. Cotton comes to Harlem, and he's got these two great black detectives and who are working with the New York Police Department, but they're very much kind of working for themselves and working to secure their community in their way. They have no problem breaking laws to fulfill their view of justice. And they're very often fighting simultaneously against forces of gangland corruption and criminals and the kind of white authorities who don't have any interest in helping out the black community. And so his two main characters are Gravedigger Jones and Coffinhead Johnson. And I don't know, there's again, an energy and a style. And that's one of the things I would say that all these writers, we don't, people love the English style detective novels because of the puzzle, because of the mystery. These books, most of them, you really don't care who done it.
It's the style that's cool.
It's the writing style and the characters. You like spending, you know, 200 pages because they're all short novels. The only long novel of any of these is Chandler's The Long Goodbye, which is probably the most significantly literary novel out of them in some ways. But
the thing about Himes is that essentially those books paved the way for the black exploitation movies of the 70s. And they established certain character types in black fiction that could be presented as sort of parody figures. Cotton Comes to Harlem was actually made into a movie, of course, and very popular movie. I believe that's a studio movie and not quite a black exploitation independent movie. But certainly all of the heroes we think of like Shaft and...
You don't have Shaft if you don't have Chester Himes.
And Sweet Sweetback and, you know, Foxy Brown and all of them. You don't have that sort of pulpy irony of black life because, quite honestly, one of the things that Harlem Renaissance made clear was you took that world very seriously as a way to bring dignity to black life. But these are very stereotypical characters. They can be sometimes uncomfortable, I think, in some of the jokes and some of the references and in some of the depictions of women. You know, there's usually all prostitutes. But it is, once you get past that, they really just kind of grab you by the lapels and they roam really quickly.
Absolutely. Now, we've gone through a quick hit, you know, a hit, a lick, and a promise of some great noir novels from the first half into the sixth decade of the 20th century. Are there a few others with cannon fodder, other ones we should recommend, Kirk, that you would probably just bring up a few books that'll just come to mind? I've got a few.
Okay. You drop a few and then I'll drop a few.
So, one of the leading art critics in America in the 50s and 60s was a guy named, or 40s, 50s, 60s, a guy named Charles Williford, who also wrote some noir books that are often about art crime and the burnt orange heresy.
Mm-hmm.
And the pickup would be a couple of these, and just excellent writer.
I'm also a big fan of Williford's Cockfighter.
Yeah.
That was made into a great movie with Oates, but also Memphis Blues, which is, I think, sort of kickstarted his second stage of his career and was made into a very good movie with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Alec Baldwin early in his career.
In addition to him, I'd throw out David Goodis, who wrote a book called The Piano, or Shoot the Piano Player. And he was kind of he's a Jewish American writer who's writing about these characters who are kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time and who are, you know, kind of good people born to quote unquote good families who are slumming and how these things work out for them.
I love Sarah Paretsky's books. I think a lot of those are very interesting on the V.I. Warshawski, where you get these, you get women playing with a lot of these tropes. And it's interesting to see how a lot of genre writers, especially younger ones, are blending different genres together. And so you get Megan Abbott doing novels that are essentially kind of noir versions of young adult fiction, and I don't mean to suggest that somehow it's written for teenagers, but it takes those sort of young person's occupations, popularity in the high school, and it turns it around and really shows how dark that world can be.
I think that's absolutely right. The people are willing to do some very different kinds of things, and you see a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers that are writing mysteries in that other world as well. Now, a couple of other writers I would throw out there. One would be Walter Mosley, who really has had two different series. One was a pretty straightforward detective series that is so realistic and beautifully written and just so smart. The Easy Rollins series, which starts with Devil in a Blue Dress. And I think Mosley has been maybe the most significant writer in crime fiction the last 25 years.
Interestingly, you know, you remember how he was kind of discovered or popularized was they asked Bill Clinton early in his presidency who his favorite writer was, and he said Walter Mosley, and that sort of drew a lot of attention to him and led to the movie version of Devil in a Blue Dress, if I'm not mistaken,
which put Don Cheadle on the map.
Right.
Playing and Denzel Washington. It's one of his first movies. It's a very good film.
You can almost think of Easy Rollins as kind of a tribute to the Chester Himes, because that's set in that sort of late 40s, early 50s sort of Blue Dahlia era, when If He Hollers, Let Him Go is actually also set.
And one thing I think that really makes Mosley stand apart is there's no sentimental or wish fulfillment or fantasy infecting the literature. Meaning, if you see a Quentin Tarantino movie that has a historical purchase, like Inglourious Basterds or Django Unchained, and of course he makes a whole point of this in the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood movie, it completely ignores historical reality and instead makes it a fantasia.
Yeah.
Right. So you have characters being empowered who would never be empowered. You know, you have Hitler being bumped off in the third year of the war by a Jewish woman in a theater. And I hate to give away the, you know, one of the ending moments of Inglourious Basterds, says you haven't seen it yet. But there's your spoiler warning after the fact. Sorry. But Mosley doesn't take it easy on Rollins. He has Rollins be worried about how he deals with the white authorities. He has him having to navigate these waters very carefully. And he also, and I'd also recommend his, is it Socrates Fortlow?
Mm-hmm.
Is his later character from one of the other. He has a couple of series, and they're all well worth your time trouble. One other writer I'd throw out there would be Daniel Woodrell, Kirk. His early writers were called Cajun Noir, and they're pretty straightforward. They're not bad. They're nothing special. But boy, then he hits a few noir novels with Tomato Red and The Death of Sweet Mister, and then finally Winter's Bone, which is actually very literary, although also a crime novel.
He's often described for his experimentation with language as the Shakespeare of the Ozarks.
Yeah, just an exceptional writer. And if you like James M. Cain, and if you like Dorothy B. Hughes, then Daniel Woodrell's book, Tomato Red, is where you got to go next. And it's a perfect marriage of kind of those two and probably Jim Thompson.
Yep.
So, Kirk, coming up next is?
We are going to tackle Saul Bellow's 1953 novel, The Adventures of Augie March, which is a great American picaresque.
And very much kind of, I think, in a different mode of writing than we've covered so far. It's kind of a whole different voice in American literature, which has become, you could argue, post-50s, one of the most common kinds of significant American writings.
It's almost a voice of epic assimilation, if you want to think of it as that way. It's an effort to capture sort of the voice of the representative American, making the argument very important that the immigrant is at the basis of American identity.
Which is, as always, it seems every few years, of very paramount importance again, as it has been before. Well, we thank you for listening to this very special episode of the Great American Novel Podcast. Please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you are so inclined, please leave us a favorable review. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you may enjoy others such as Master of 40 with Kirk and Robert Trogdon, focusing on the short stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Reading McCarthy with myself and various guests about the works of Cormac McCarthy.
And please remember, you can always email us at greatamericannovelspodcast@gmail.com. We've actually had a couple email messages lately, so that's been very reassuring. But we do thank those of you who are listening for tuning in, and we look forward to seeing you in our next episode. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.